Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 122. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. I'm a huge fan of the arts. I create art, view art, and facilitate art. I also think research is crucial to understanding and working with children, youth, families, and communities. When these two things come together, art and research, and combined with a community-building, social justice, action-oriented focus, I think we are firmly in the realm of transformative child and youth care. Today's guest does all of that and so much more. Amelia Murhar is an artist, a researcher, a facilitator, and a wonderfully fun, inspiring person. Most recently, she also just started working as a child welfare policy analyst for the Council of Yukon First Nations up in the chilly north of Canada. Thank you so much for joining me today, Amelia.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation. When I was thinking about this interview, I kept writing questions, and I would start with you, and then I would switch it, and I'd start to the research, and then I would start with you, and I'd start with the research, and I realized I wasn't quite sure where to start our conversation with you or with the research. So I'd like to start with a skirt. I'd like to start with with your skirt, as a matter of fact. In your thesis, which we're going to talk about momentarily, it's called Moving Home, the Art and Embodiment of Transient Among Youth Emerging from Canada's Child Welfare System. I've seen several shows related to this project, and I've read your thesis. And on the homepage of your website is a skirt that
yes.
you wore, that you repaired and wore and repaired. Can you tell me a little bit about that skirt and the significance of it related to your thesis?
For sure. So my research used arts-based research methods. So instead of asking young people who had grown up in the system, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how messed up are you? You know, instead of anything quantifiable like that, already pre-made questions, I wanted to amplify youth voice and just really provide a space for peers to get together. And so I used arts-based research methods, and I used them in a very different way where youth could create, they were considered co-researchers. So co-researchers could use any medium they wanted, you know. So I partnered with arts organizations, and so there's hip hop. I have worked in 13 different mediums. So I've got dream catchers, got hip hop, photography, textiles. And so my textile piece, was part of the Toronto show. So at one point in my life, I was homeless. I was a train hopper. I hitchhiked around, and I had this skirt, you know, used to be jeans, and then the thighs blew out. So it became a skirt, and it was what I wore for the years I was traveling around. And, you know, there's patches from ex-boyfriends, there's patches from places I visited, there's like a New Orleans patch because I was in New Orleans post-Katrina. And so I never made the skirt as art. The skirt was just what I wore. And I've held on to it for over a decade, not wanting to let it go, but like not knowing what to do with it. Cause you know, it's dirty. I sewed it with dental floss. Like I held on to it cause I knew it was important. And I'm like, what can I do with this? Like, it's not going to make a nice pillow. Like nobody wants to snuggle their face onto this like rusty punk homeless skirt, but I couldn't let it go. So I ran the project first in Toronto with 10 co-researchers, and I ran it at Sketch Working Arts. And it was a very big project. I was a very ambitious master's student. I probably could have done a PhD with all the research and data I collected.
Having read it, you definitely could have done a PhD.
Yeah. And I had dreamed bigger at the start. So I love art. I make art, performance, installation, music, sound art. I was hoping arts-based research for me was a hack. It was a way to develop my artistic practice and fuse it with my community development and activism. So arts-based research for me was a way to fuse these interests, but hopefully get to make some art myself, right? Well, Toronto Project didn't work like that. I was very busy running around getting supplies for people, providing meals, because sometimes Sketch provided meals, sometimes I had to make them, and just supporting people in their projects. And just, there was a lot more admin stuff, mainly driving around the city looking for very particular art supplies that took up a lot of my time. So I didn't get to make art for the Toronto Project, but there was another young artist who wanted to remain anonymous from the project, but they did textile work too. They'd also been in the scene and train hopping punk on the streets. And they were doing patch-based work. And I was like, oh, wow, this skirt. Like, I'm studying the embodiment of transience. And then I suddenly saw the reason I'd been holding onto the skirt for over a decade. It's art now. It's art. It's my representation of the embodiment of transience. I wore this skirt through 35 states and coast to coast across Canada multiple times. You know, it's very worn down. I was sitting on cement all the time. I had to repair it. Held together with like dirt and dental floss, because that's what you sew with, because it's way better than thread and you don't have to tie it. You can just burn it with the wax. So what I was thinking about living out embodied transience, I suddenly saw this personal artifact. I'm like, oh, it's art now. And so I was very happy to have something to contribute to the show that I felt was very personally meaningful. But also very, very relevant to this topic I had been studying.
Why was it important for you to contribute to the show? And I say that, or contribute to the project. And I say that because many researchers position themselves apart from rather than a part of.
Yeah, well, I entered the youth in care, like I entered the space through being a former youth in care myself. Mm-hmm. So I'm very politically aware of doing research and doing research with particular communities and like how I position myself. And I personally feel more ethically grounded and more comfortable entering a space where I have some lived experience. I'm a white woman who grew up in Toronto, so my experience is different than that of a Black youth or an Indigenous person in the North. However, we do share the experience of being caught up in the child welfare system and knowing that that sucks. So in terms of building rapport, I think it helped. It was made it very clear why I'm passionate about this topic. And people can talk about objectivity in research, but I think that's a lie. I think that's a lie in the sense that if you're a biologist and you're doing research, like you're in biology because you care about it, right? Like complete and total objectivity is a lie that people like to tell themselves. We're all doing the things we're doing. Maybe we need the money. Maybe we're passionate about it. Maybe we're trying to emulate somebody. But there's reasons for all of this, and they're not objective. So that's why it was important for me to contribute something. Like, I didn't, you know, some people made multiple artworks. I just wanted one thing. And it was kind of cool to have this thing that I've, this skirt that mattered to me, and then suddenly, just through the lens of the project, it went from a personal artifact to art.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing piece. Looking at the piece, you said no one would want to snuggle up to it, but it to me reeks of history, right? Like there's something about it that very much captures what you've been talking about. One of the terms you've used several times in your conversation, use actually in your thesis title, is this phrase embodied transience. Can you explain that a bit more, what you mean by embodied transience?
Yeah, I, it's, Well, you know, I'm the first one to be talking about it in this way. So pretty ambitious for a master's student. Essentially an inner restlessness, tying it into the experience of having multiple placements. Some youth I worked with, some co-researchers had been in over 30 homes. Some couldn't count how many homes they were in. So in order to be part of this project, you had to live in at least three different homes, because I wanted to explore all this moving around, especially at such a formative time. And the reality is, for youth in Toronto, 70% of them are placed in the suburbs. So when they're going into a foster home or a group home, it's not just like, oh, I'm a couple blocks away, I can still go to the same school. No, you're entering an entirely different world, and then probably another one and another one and another one. So I was looking at how moving around so much and essentially being more comfortable moving around every couple months, like, does that become a habit? Is that something that the system, just through how it's organized, that happens? And then now, as we're adults, because I only worked with people who'd aged out of the system, now that we're adults, are we still perpetuating that? How do we think, as young adults, moving around so much has impacted us? And that's where youth really were co-researchers, taking this idea, like, what sort of people is the child welfare system inadvertently creating through all these moves? That's where the co-researcher part really came in. And they could explore it through relationships. They could explore it through emotions. They could explore it through hip hop. And so I have my own ideas when I started this project about the embodiment of transience, and I had my own questions. But when I worked with people, I tried to keep it a bit more open, because I didn't want to just like project my ideas, but I wanted to question the long-term lived effects and connecting it to the body, not just feelings and mental states. Essentially, you know, we talk about fight or flight mode, fight, flight, freeze. Embodiment of transience, sort of like living in permanent flight mode, because that feels safer.
So you obviously embodied transience in a pretty profound way with your 35 states and multiple crossings around the country. And since I've known you, I don't know how many times you've been different. Texting's great, because you know, you wherever you are, I can get in touch or email. Did you find that same sense of movement with other co-researchers?
What I found really differed on where I was in the country. Emotionally, there was definitely always like a disconnection, but there's so many overlapping and intersectional issues. So poverty, the criminal justice system, homelessness, northern housing shortage, all these things are other factors on why young people are moving around so much, let alone young people emerging from the care system. So it's hard to really separate that, but I was looking at the feeling of restlessness. And for the most part, with the Toronto group, we had a really great discussion on sort of a spectrum of embodied transience. And most people identified, even when we were doing sort of, there was a little interview to do the project, and people identified with being a wanderer or a traveler. And there was a small subset who hated moving, never wanted to move again. Their home was their castle. So that was their response. So what I found throughout, moving's not neutral. Now, I'm not saying like the average person loves moving, but it's a little more emotionally charged for youth emerging from the care system. So moving's definitely not neutral. And most people identify as being less grounded, whether it's less connected to their culture or just losing people in the system. Maybe they had, you know, known people when they were in foster homes and group homes, and then they got shipped out to another one. They sort of lost touch with that community that they'd started to make. But yeah, it really, the sense of alienation from moving was much more profound in Toronto. And I talked earlier about how so many youth in Toronto are placed in the suburbs. And that's, I mean, that can be really devastating for any teenager, let alone one that's already had probably a traumatic past, because they're in the child welfare system. Where were you go ahead.
You keep talking about Toronto, and your other project was up in the north in Whitehorse and the Yukon, or your other site.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see in the site in Whitehorse that was different from the Toronto folks?
So there was 10 co-researchers in Toronto and 5 in the Yukon. And the Yukon co-researchers were all First Nations, Inuit or Métis. In order to be statistically representative, I only needed 80%, but it just turned out that everybody was of an Indigenous background. So the interesting thing I found in the Yukon was that there was a greater sense of community. No matter, there's only 3 high schools in Whitehorse, right? So even if you lived in every single home, which some people did, there was a greater sense of identity. Like no matter what, you were still from the Yukon, you were still from the North. And so it looked like smaller communities, or at least in this case, it was a protective factor against really, really substantial alienation, because you could still go to the same school. You could still, like, some of the people in the project already knew each other. Some of the people in the project had been in the same group homes together. And this was just me, you know, doing posters and outreach. I've done a lot of youth work, so it wasn't too hard to find young people. And so just this idea of community and culture and identity, and how the project in the Yukon was a lot more grounded. And it was also the second time I did the project, and I had hired an assistant to help me, who was an art therapist, which was really great, to help me facilitate workshops in the morning and like set up food and stuff. And we also had an elder ground our practice. So Elder Frances Wolseley, she worked in the child welfare system, and she just grounded our research with a opening and closing prayer, and it was available to youth if they wanted to talk. And so I think that also helped ground and add culture and community to the Yukon project. But in terms of findings, it's a stronger sense of identity and community just at the very base level, as opposed to me bringing 10 people from very different backgrounds in Toronto together. The only thing they share is having been in care. Right. So it was a lot more emotionally charged.
Yeah. You said earlier that the work that you do is less about, you know, or it's not at all about, you know, a questionnaire and quantifiable responses that you're going to run through a analysis.
Regression analysis and SPSS.
Exactly. I'm wondering if you could explain to us a little bit about how art functions as a process for research. What does that look like? I mean, you say you worked with 13 different mediums. How does art function as a site of inquiry, a site of analysis, and a site of dissemination?
Well, worked with any medium possible, right? Because youth were co-researchers and they got to choose. It just ended up being 13 mediums. It could have been 15 if everybody wanted to pick a different one, right? So in terms of art as inquiry, I mean, all art is kind of inquiry. You're exploring relationships. But in terms of arts-based research, I'm biased towards art and I'm biased towards youth. So those are like, biases, I'll be very upfront about my biases in my research. I'm pretty sure I state that in my introduction, or at least in my methods. But because I'm asking people to reflect not on just like one home they had, I'm asking them to reflect on the sum total of every single group home and foster home and kinship care placement. That can be bringing up a lot of emotions, bringing up a lot of negative memories. And so art facilitated this research in a lot of ways. It gave people something material to do, to get stuff out of them, instead of just focusing on words as if talking is the only way to share knowledge. And by challenging traditional arts-based research, which is like often theater or photo voice, which is the arts-based research term for photography, By letting people do what they want, I mean, how you say something matters. A hip-hop track versus Dreamcatchers, those are different mediums. And before you even know what the artist statement is and what the youth or what the topic is, those are, they're saying different things just for the medium they're in. And I think how we say things matters. And by opening up the mediums and just even by letting it be artistic, people who are quieter can speak up more. You know, everyone could be part of the art show. The art show was not mandatory. But another reason, I've done a lot of work in nonprofits, and there's always little research projects because there's always little bits of money you apply for to do this thing. And then you release this report, you know, a couple people who care about the organization come, and then that's it. And you're off to like running your services again. And so this is an important social issue. And by having art shows, it's a way to engage with the public on a different level. I'm not like hitting them over the head with some boring, you know, gray literature report. They can connect just intuitively with certain works more than others. They may be able to chat with the artist. They can read the artist's statement. And so it's reaching out beyond the community of people who already care about youth and care issues. And I think that's really important. The project had a total of 4 art shows, 2 in the Yukon and 2 in Toronto, 1 at a real gallery, 1 at an art school, and 2. So when you talk about arts-based research, there's like the site of representation, which is like what is depicted in the artwork. There's the site of creation, like where was the art made? And then there's the site of presentation, where you are showing the art. And so 2 of the art shows were in the same places that we made the art because I partnered with these youth art organizations. So it was a way to raise their profile, but also it's a nice way to celebrate. Like we did this and we're done. And Do you still want to talk about this? What do you think? What did you learn? You know, some people sold stuff. Oh, super interesting. 80% of the youth in Toronto tried to hustle and sell their art. 20% of the youth in the Yukon tried to sell their art. Oh. Like in terms of like, when I mean try to sell, I mean priced it.
Yeah,
and like that speaks to economic things. That speaks to culture. What is art for? Because a lot of the art in the Yukon was given as gifts after it was created. So, I mean, all the art the co-researchers made was still their property. All I collected was like a copy of the song or a photo and an artist statement. And the artist statement for me was very grounding. We did a workshop on how to create artist statements. And yeah. You should probably ask me another question now.
I'm just so appreciating your reflections. It's really I'm getting caught up in the story. You talked about the presentation, and it's a way to engage people who might not otherwise be thinking about these topics or engaging with this area. What has been the response to the work and the research?
When
I say the work, I mean the art and then sort of the research. And I know that's a really crass way of me sort of distinguishing, but I'm going to be crass for a moment.
So the art shows, I mean, I partnered with Sketch in Toronto. So I just tagged on to their Rad Grad event for the art show because that meant couple hundred people were going to see it, which was great because a couple hundred people saw it. And CBC has been really supportive of the project, either at the local station here in Whitehorse. I did a couple interviews about when I was doing outreach, and then about the art show, and then just about the issue of Indigenous youth in care and why this project matters and why you should come to the show. It's been very well received. I mean, for a master's research project, most of my friends do not have articles written about their research. But I've done, this would be the 8th or 9th interview/article about the project thus far.
And what is it about this project what is it about the world right now that wants to hear about this project?
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, really, like, the first recommendation they made was to reduce the number of Indigenous kids in care. The first call to action, I should say. It's when the stats came out that there's more Indigenous youth in care today than were ever in residential schools. I mean, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit activists have been saying this for a very long time, but things have started to shift in the past couple years. And, like, Cindy Blackstock has been doing a ton of work raising hell, and, you know, the Human Rights Tribunal and Jordan's Principle and all these things have been building to raise awareness about youth in care. And this is another thing that has come out of the project is that, so being a former youth in care, it's an invisible social identity. You walk down the street, no one knows you used to be in the system. And when you come from a messed up family, like, often your family is messed up for a very long time. So it's not just like things change and you're an adult and you're on your own. You might cry every Mother's Day or every Father's Day, or like whinge a little when you hear your friends complaining about their parents. And in your mind, you're like, you have nothing to complain about. But we don't have a space to talk about that in society. But so former youth in care are creating the community they need. There's about 500 to 600 former youth in care in Ontario alone who identify as activists, who are trying to make things better, and they have political weight. They've been sharing their stories and changing policy through their work. So it's a very fragmented community, but so many former youth in care are becoming advocates for the community and trying to give back. And so the graduation rates, the post-secondary graduation rates for former youth in care are about 5% nationally. And when young people do make it through post-secondary, we're still fixated on youth in care. We become social workers or child and youth care workers, or me, I'm in geography, human geography, but still. But this was the issue I wanted to explore. We're hung up on it. We need to process it. And I have to say, this project has been very personally transformative for me, going back and giving back to this community, not only through trying to develop research and a research process that benefits people. I want to leave people in a better place than they were when I met them. And maybe that's like, you know, people got paid, people got bus tickets, people got food, people got an art show, people got workshops. And so that's really my desire. It's part of my ethics as a researcher, is to leave people in a better place with connections to what they're interested in. And so, yeah, this project has done very well. I got the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada Award to honor Nelson Mandela in 2017.
Amazing.
So it's just like a regular SHRC grant, but it's essentially like top 10 master's research projects working with youth in Canada. 2 weeks ago, I got my department master's award, and I'm still up for two more awards at York.
Way to go.
So, and I also got a sweet new job. That's the real.
You mean, you know, you have created a discussion. I mean, I can't speak to UConn at all, but certainly Toronto and your project and the Advocates Office support, and then the Advocates Office, you know, finding ways to support you in presenting your work and facilitating conversations.
We made a zine.
The zine is super awesome, and I'm going to post on the CYC podcast website links to your page and to the zine, and I've shown your zine at conferences, and anyways, it's great. It's an amazing project, and I agree. I think in your project you've helped make community, and it's a lovely, lovely piece of work, and I want to thank you for the work. It's informed me tremendously. It's inspired me. It's motivated me, and it's really I've chatted about this project probably more than any other master's project that I'm aware of.
So have you officially cited me yet? Like, should
I haven't, but I will.
Because, like, you know, once those citations start rolling in.
There you go. Get your author's index climbing up there, Amelia.
Yeah. Whoever reads my 168-page thesis, you know?
Well, you know, you're probably a heck of a lot more than who read most master's theses.
Yeah, but that's why I think it's super important, once again, to make that zine. Like, do you know how good it felt to condense 168 pages into two without any citations? Like, oh, my God, it was liberating. The different part about the zine, it was, once again, this activism. Like, people didn't have to contribute to the zine. I pitched the idea because I'm really into not only, like, doing art shows as a way to share research with the public, but also this zine is intended for anyone who works with youth from the system or young people themselves who are still in the system wondering about their futures. And so youth from the project, co-researchers wrote letters on self-care or letting them know things are going to be okay eventually. And that's really powerful too, because I got a lot from giving back and sort of mentoring my community of former youth in care. And then, like, so did these co-researchers who chose to be vulnerable and reach out to young people they don't even know, but they do know what they're going through.
Absolutely. Amelia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. Congratulations on an excellent piece of research, and congratulations on your new job. And I really, really hope you find ways to continue researching, because I think you have...
Oh, I got accepted to do a PhD.
Oh! Boom! Now that's so great. That's amazing. Congratulations.
Yeah, I can't talk about it too much yet, but very exciting because, I'm continuing to look at embodied transience, but with a different community.
Amazing. You start in September?
We'll see. If my contract gets extended, I'll stay and continuing to do policy work. But if it doesn't, back to school.
Way to go, girl. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to our next conversation, Amelia.
You too. Thanks for having me.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.